Namaste and welcome to the new episode of Tridam Chautari podcast. Myself, Deepa Adhikari, presenting you about current issues related to internet and its use, challenges and opportunities surrounding COVID-19 pandemic. Today in this episode, we are incorporating online conversation that was hosted by the Internet Society Asia Pacific Bureau, which is one of the series of online conversations. Basically, discussion is focused on the role of internet played in helping communities deal with coronavirus pandemic. Panelists for the discussion are Ellen Strickland, Chief Advisor, International Internet Anger, New Zealand; Oshama Mantor, Founder Director, Digital Empowerment Foundation, India; Shaman Ahmad Savir, Chief Technology Officer, Fiber at Home Limited, Bangladesh; also Asia Pacific Internet Society, Adren One. Program was moderated by Rajnish Singh, Regional Vice President, Asia Pacific Internet Society. Questions addressed during discussion are: how would it have been if the internet didn't exist in the way it does today? What aspects have worked well? What hasn't worked well? Were there any special internet offers by service providers in the wake of COVID-19, and how has that helped? What are some of the key learnings we have in using the internet to deal with pandemic? What about those who are not online, which is a large part of our region in rural areas and includes minority and marginalized communities? Are there any particular policy or infrastructure related initiatives that can be highlighted as best practice? These are the some questions where discussion will be focused on. Now, let's listen to the discussion.
The way we'll do this today is, you know, I'll try and make this as dynamic and as interactive as we can. So there'll be no slides, there'll be no drawn out speeches and so on. And we'll try and, of course, also have questions fielded from various people who are joining us remotely. And to help us with that, I have my colleague Adrian Wan, who will be fielding some of these questions for us from the field, as it were. And of course, we'll put it across to our speakers to see if they can shed any light on those. With that, one other quick thing. If you are participating remotely and if you want to ask some of the panelists a question, please do so. If you're on the Zoom platform, please do so using the Q&A. You will see the Q&A little icon on your screen at the bottom, usually, or perhaps at the top if you're on a tablet or mobile device. That way we can keep track of what you're asking, and some of the speakers, of course, might very well answer those questions directly instead of waiting to speak to verbalize the answer. Similarly, if you're on any of the other platforms, live stream and Facebook and so on, please put your questions in the chat and we'll try and get as many answered as we can. We can't promise we'll answer all of those. Obviously, we have a very short time to do this in, but let's see how we go. So to start things off, let me bring in Ellen. Ellen, so, you know, New Zealand was perhaps one of the early movers in terms of lockdowns and very decisive, in fact, in what it did and how it did it. I think we can also safely say as a result of that, we've seen the number of infections and deaths perhaps the lowest in the world, or at least close to it, if I'm not mistaken. Restrictions are easing across the ditch in Australia. You know, I think we've sort of shared that slight easing of restrictions. So let's see how that turns out. But in terms of what happened as the lockdowns came in place, I also recall Internet New Zealand itself had even trialed a work from home program prior to, I think, the lockdowns being put in place to see how things would function. So perhaps you could share some views with us on how, as an organization, Internet New Zealand coped with working from home, but as well what you saw in New Zealand as a whole. You know, how were people coping and what role did the internet play in all that?
Sure, thanks, Raj. I mean, I think, you know, New Zealand has gotten a bit of coverage in the media for the way that what our Prime Minister described as the hard and fast approach we took to responding to COVID-19. For Internet New Zealand, it's something that we had on our radar from January, actually, and that I'd attended a conference in Hawaii, Pacific Telecommunications Council. And at that stage, there were cases starting and some sort of, you know, notifications going around about cases that have been on planes. And so within Internet NZ, we'd activated a team to start thinking about, you know, what that could mean for us as an organization and for New Zealand, you know, if there was a global pandemic. And So I guess it was maybe 10 days before the actual New Zealand lockdown, we did a 3-day trial as a part of a special working group on COVID-19. And we decided to do a 3-day trial. We do a lot of working from home or internet and Zed, but usually it's for a day or two and people come in and out. And the idea that everybody go home and try it out, not just for a day, because it's easy to kind of make do for a day, but for 3 days. And we did that and found there were certainly some challenges to it for people, both logistically, but also kind of, psychologically, logistically. Not everybody has space in their home. And then it was, I guess it would be about a week and a day after that, we were informed of the alert level system in New Zealand by the Prime Minister, and it really became very clear to the New Zealand public that there was likely to be action needing to be taken, and that that would include activating work from home. So as part of it, was we have a 4-tier system, and from tier 2, which is they activated it and said you're now at level 2, it encouraged work from home from anyone who could. It was then only 4 days until we were into complete lockdown. So 2-3 days later, they announced that we were at level 3, and then in 48 hours, we would be at level 4. And at level 4, it was one of the most sort of hard lockdowns in the world. It really was everybody go home and stay home. The only things that were open were supermarkets and pharmacies, but that a lot of your interaction needed to be online. And so that was working if you could, that was school, that was government services, medical services, your GP, buying from the supermarket or the pharmacy if you could, although those were still open if people needed to go out. But connecting with your family, we had a concept of a bubble. And so people who lived in your house were your bubble and you weren't to be in touch with anyone else. But that means a lot of things for mental health, you know, and people's family connections who are bigger. And so really, we were very lucky in New Zealand. What we found from our trial, and I think played out for broader New Zealand, is that over the last, 10 years, probably longer, actually, maybe 20, successive governments had invested in internet infrastructure. We had an ultra-fast broadband initiative, a rural broadband initiative, and those had put in place a network that could cope with a lot of use and people going home, and that people had, you know, there'd been good uptake through a lot of work by a lot of players in telecommunications as well as government. And it meant that all those things going online certainly saw heavier demand and different demand than you would when people are in the offices. But the internet network, you know, performed well and was able to do all those things, you know. And I think it was a real moment for us as Internet and Zed in preparing for it and for the country of realizing that the internet is important in a way, you know, that it amplifies its importance when you're at home, staying home for an extended period, which ended up being 5 weeks of complete lockdown and another couple of weeks. And as you said, we are going back out into the world now, but we see, we'll see how that plays out. But I think that it's changed people's perspectives on the internet. Working for home, for example, is something I think that it's been a real mindset shift for people to realize how possible it is for a lot of roles. And of course, for a lot of it isn't.
And, I'm hoping we'll talk a little bit more about working from home a bit later in the session, because that in itself, I think, brings up some interesting dimensions to, you know, how we can function. You mentioned there's the psychological angle as well, obviously, but as well as productivity and efficiency as well, I think will come into play. So we'll hold the thought and hopefully come back to that. Let me bring in Osama from Delhi. So from one of the decisive early lockdown countries to the world's largest lockdown. Osama, I think many of us saw, at least many of us overseas, saw on TV how there was this somewhat rather massive internal migration of laborers and daily wage workers from various metros and tier 2 and 3 cities back to their homes as the lockdowns were announced. Some of the images were actually quite distressing, and I think even Indian media has covered it quite significantly. What That also brings up is that, you know, most of these people, of course, were moving back to rural areas, to their villages and so on. And knowing that, you know, we have challenges in India in terms of access and connectivity in rural areas, knowing that, you know, these are the poorest of the poor who had to then, you know, in one case, you know, on TV here in Australia last night, we had a program that was showing that interviewing these people who were intending to walk 1,300 kilometers back to Bihar to get home because there was no public transport or other means and they didn't have the financial means otherwise. But apart from the financial issues and the logistics issues around that, there's also the case that, you know, for a country that size, it's also very important to be able to pass timely, relevant, and accurate information to people to ensure they do the right thing. So knowing what we know, what did you see? I mean, knowing, of course, that your organization works quite a bit in rural areas. So perhaps you can share some thoughts on how you saw that evolving and what impact do you see going forward? And, of course, maybe some general comments on how India has handled the lockdown and what role the internet has played. You're muted, Osama.
So thank you, Raj. And I wanted to say hello to Ellen and Suman. Being a co-panelist, we can't hold hands of each other to, you know, give what kind of question and answer that we relate in the audience. But now, you know, at least we should say hi to each other. And welcome to all the 100 plus and 150 plus people who are actually online. Thank you very much for joining. Raj, you are from India, so you said most of the things that, you know, what is happening in India. But just to give a perspective of lockdown, COVID, health crisis, and because of this crisis, the crisis that we have created ourselves, you know. So just to give you an idea of a broad number, and I just researched and found out because of this migration that India, though, looks like a mobile-first country and one of the second largest connected country in terms of numbers, yet our connectivity is very, very fragile. To give you an idea, out of the 70 to 80% people who are mobile connected, we do not have more than 550 million people. We have 550 million people who are connected through feature phone and prepaid connectivity. And I'll tell you why I'm saying this is because these are the people who are informal sector, laborers, migrants, villagers, who are, if at all they are connected, through feature phone and prepaid connectivity. Only 400 to 500 million people have smartphones, but out of which only 200 million people or less have rural-based connectivity to internet or smartphone-based connectivity to internet. So that gives a perspective that how low or infrastructurally low connected we are as a country, which surely because of numbers, we come number two in the world, you know, being connected. But at the time of COVID and the lockdown, like you said, internet becomes one of the most important infrastructure, no lesser than access to food, as far as things letting done is concerned. And there was a research that was done by the migrant laborers that they all needed talk time available to them without payment while they were migrating because they wanted to be in touch. So your other points that you gave us that how much ISP's role in this, how much subsidy in this, how much talk time in this is actually required in a developing countries when people are connected and relied on internet or talk time. It, how can you give those benefits to the people who are actually always connected, even if you are not being provided with food and other, because they need to be connected to access to information, you know? This the second part is, in this entire lockdown, the biggest thing that we saw is the fragility of, or the, you know, what information does to us, or the lack of it, or the misinformation. You know, the biggest casualty is information itself and the knowledge itself and the reliable information itself. Apart from the rumor, there was no reliable, proper information at the time of distress was available or has been made available. You know, the rules are changing every day. The informations are changing every day. You know, we have been doing as an organization, serving to the migrants in a local area near Delhi on a highway, giving support. And what we are finding out is that people have no information from where the bus will go or from where the, you know, transport will go. You know, and then they are not allowed to go from this border to that border and that border, you know. So there is a whole lot of confusion in terms of information. And that's the second part that we didn't know. And this has nothing to do with pandemic itself, you know. I'm not even talking about health pandemic itself, you know, which is a separate fight altogether. We are talking how this created economic crisis, how this created humanitarian crisis, how this created access to food crisis, and access to information crisis, you know. So those were very much part of the governance and the system that we already have created, but we just didn't know how to handle it. So, you know, in a country like India, where the informal sector, do you know that the informal sector is 440 million in India? All of them at the moment, as you said, are on the roads, either to go back home or to find alternative livelihood, because 2 months of lockdown has also lost all the patience of the person who was supposed to pay to them or to give them, excuse them for their rents and things like that. So everything is actually now is squeezed out. You know, nobody is any more ready to give succor to the people whom they were hosting. You know, most of the people are unpaid and all that. But coming to internet, I would like to highlight that availability of access to information, access to data, and access to talk time is one of the biggest thing that any government like India should have made available, and we wrote to the Prime Minister as an organization that it should have been made, is the first thing that any organization, any country that must make available. And I will stop that, but we will come back on the second round to share more about this.
So, you know, this informal sector and you know, that 440 million, I think you said, just the scale is astounding. And yes. And then if we take Bangladesh, of course, you know, which shares some similar demographics to India. So someone, of course, you run a very large infrastructure provider, and you've got a fiber network across the country. You have an international gateway and other things as well. So I think it would be interesting to hear what your perspectives are as a very large network operator, infrastructure provider, on what you saw happening. Obviously, Bangladesh is heavily dependent on exports, you know, garments is one thing that you do. And obviously all that due to logistics, supply chains, and so on and so forth, as well as retail chains being closed all across the world. Obviously, there's an impact on that, and people have to stay home, in addition to the lockdown and in addition to the other issues that prevail. So perhaps you could share some views with us from your perspective on how you saw things evolving. And as well, maybe you could also touch on what you saw from the infrastructure perspective. You know, one of the concerns many people were raising when lockdown started was that the internet wouldn't cope. I think what we've seen pretty much all across the world is the internet actually did cope. Most of the problems were in the last mile or the middle mile. They were not really a problem with core internet infrastructure. So maybe you could also share some thoughts on that from your perspective.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Actually, first, I will just say that from the talk from Osama, that it's basically a similar thing happened here, which is smaller scale, because the country is small, but population density may be higher than India, but it's kind of a what I should say that internet and technology give us a lot of opportunity to manage it much better way. But unfortunately, we have miserably failed to take the advantage of the technology in terms of management, in terms of prediction, in terms of erring people. Same thing happened here. And lack of coordination among different stakeholders. The major fault happened here in Bangladesh during this lockdown. We started in a similar time with India. We stopped everything, closed everything. And we could have claimed like New Zealand that we also survived in a better way, but we couldn't do that. Maybe there's one reason is the population, huge population, and main reason is the lack of coordination. You talked about garments industries, and they created the first mistake that, we have a lot of orders, we need to open up somehow, we'll make social distancing and we'll work in a small scale, we should start. When they just opened up, we see thousands and thousands of people actually coming up from different part of the country to the Dhaka and other cities where these garment industries are. There is no communication, so they have to walk, they have to take different kind of transport medium, different places they came to Dhaka. And when there is a lot of questions in the media, oh, no, we are not open. We are closed for another week. So these people again went back. So you can just think of that, how these small mistakes can actually help spread the virus. And I can name many different kind of uses like this. This is one side of it. But still, eventually, we should say that comparably, infection is comparatively lower, but it's growing now. And probably we need to go for another strict lockdown in a short time. We don't know about that. Let's just move to internet. Let's not talk about internet, actually, internet and infrastructure, actually, how we are handling. First thing I should say that the uses of internet, that before pre-COVID situation, internet is different for different people. For us, it's a kind of, we do everything over internet, like the techie people and other who are dealing with internet. Some it's only entertainment, some it's only business, some for communication. But in this situation, we are doing nearly everything in the internet. For me, I never actually use e-commerce actually for doing my groceries or, you know, I used to go to shop and buy, I like it. But now actually, even at the age, kind of old age, I'm not actually regularly buying things from internet. And e-commerce is one of the major boom here in Bangladesh. It was not doing well earlier, I should say. But now they're struggling to deliver product at their home. So major shift in uses. Schools. In fact, almost all the schools, actually, they are running virtual classes using Zoom, using Google Classes, using some other applications. A major shift. All the offices are going virtual. You said you will talk later on that, so I'll not go for home office at this moment. I'll talk about the infrastructure, that the use of the internet actually increased in Bangladesh perspective, I guess, see increase in 20 to 30% in different segment. In the last mile, in the home user side, is definitely increased more than 30%. And interestingly, due to the migration at the starting of the pandemic, that utilization didn't increase in the city, in the main city, Dhaka, or in the biggest cities. It increased more in the smaller cities because a large number of people actually moved from the big cities in the small cities and they're starting using there. So you can see some of the infrastructure in the remote part, actually, that they are in a small capacity, is choking and we need to increase the capacity in some places like that. So that is one interesting change we see in the infrastructure. And uses of this video and internet content is a lot. Office uses reduced significantly because people are working from home. So we can see a surge in the use of the broadband. So small ISPs, actually, they have to increase their capacity in some cases, serve the uses for need of the internet broadband users. So, and I can see the reduce in the mobile data services, that it didn't increase much because people are at home and the Wi-Fi is the lifeline in the city. Again, while there's the broadband infrastructure that people are using, actually more depending on the mobile internet. And one thing actually that really helped people and the ISP that really contribute in this situation, you know, the healthcare system is kindly in a kind of overwhelmed with the patients and they're not offering service properly. So it's very difficult to get an appointment to a doctor and talk to a doctor. But one thing really helps here is telemedicine, that some organizations came up with telemedicine services and some ISPs volunteered their IP telephone numbers because in Bangladesh, most of the big ISPs have IP telephone service and those IP telephone is connected with the mobile and the landline telephone. So this virtual call centers is now actually operating. Doctors are sitting at their home using IP number or even their cell phone. They can actually talk directly to the customer. There's a hunting number. People are calling into that particular IP telephone number and they can reach to a doctor and at least get some sort of suggestion, some sort of advice. That's become the lifeline actually for the people. So that is I think the biggest contribution in Bangladesh from the internet community to the society in this very special situation. So that is the just initial observation from my side.
So thanks, Suman. So you know the comment you made about how, you know, we've started using telemedicine more. You know, we've started using e-learning, for instance, work from itself, of course, which is a whole band of things together. So you know, one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, for literally a decade or maybe nearly two decades now, we've been talking about the promise of telemedicine. We've been talking about the promise of online education and e-learning and so on and so forth. What was somewhat surprising to me, and it is an observation I had here in Australia, was that even though we use digital technologies in our classrooms. We were not prepared to actually teach remotely, though. We were not prepared for e-learning. And schools here struggled, at least in New South Wales, I know they struggled to do that. In fact, right today, and we're starting to ease restrictions now, and school will start in a couple of weeks or next week, in fact, at least public schools will. They still are struggling to cope with delivering education over online methods. And this is a fairly wealthy, developed, advanced country, which is struggling to do that. So you can imagine how it could potentially be in other parts of the world, and you know, what would they do to cope? And similarly with telemedicine, you know, again, we've always talked about how telemedicine can revolutionize healthcare and so on. Yes, indeed, in some developing countries, I think they've been put to some good use, but largely in, you know, I don't think they were in mainstream use. It was more you know, a reactive use of the technology as opposed to a proactive use of the technology. So I think that's a nice lead-in into the next part of the conversation on, you know, what do we want? What, okay, some forces have been changed. Some things, you know, we've been forced to change the way we do a few things and how we do that. What I'm also hoping is that, you know, these changes we've been forced to make will stick, and that, you know, we'll continue to embrace some of these things and ensure that, you know, if there's another pandemic or some natural disaster or whatever else happens in future, at least we are far more better prepared to deal with those. So Alan, if I can bring you back in, you know, how do you see that playing out, you know, in terms of that? And the other little thing I want to get into is, you know, the issue about the economic impact of this. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously there's massive economic impact. But at the same time, as I think someone mentioned, that we've had new, not necessarily new industries, but industries that have adapted themselves to try and improve what they do and deal with the situation. Food delivery was one example. You know, the ecosystem that exists around working from home. And as an example, here in Australia, you could not buy webcams and mics for a couple of weeks because they were all sold out. And the pricing was ridiculous, you know. What I normally would have paid $100 for, I was paying $250 for. Sanitizer was selling for $50 for a small bottle, whereas you could buy that for $4.95 back in the day, you know. So perhaps some thoughts in and around those from you, Alan.
Yeah, Raj. I mean, I think we certainly are going to see innovation and change going forward, driven in part by what you said, is that some of the things that we've learned are going to continue. And I think it's very interesting. I'd actually noted, so today the Director General of Health for New Zealand actually said that telemedicine is one of the things that has very much surprised everyone in the health sector, and that how well it works. And realizing that for a lot of, obviously not for everything, but for a range of especially sort of general practitioner issues where it's somebody you have a relationship with, more routine things, sometimes follow-up meetings with a specialist after a procedure, that can be done online, and it actually works very well for everyone. It's more comfortable for patients who might be recovering, you know, reduces communicable diseases, all kinds of things. So we actually said that they're going to be doing a major piece of work now within New Zealand and the health sector to realign how that would work in terms of paying GPs, in terms of a whole sector revamp, basically. And I certainly took a moment of sort of laughing, as having been in internet, you know, sort of policy work for ages, that we've been saying this for decades, and that it took seeing it in action for them to say, oh, actually, this is really, you know, it doesn't replace having one-to-one consultations completely, but it has a place and it can be a really valuable thing. So that's a really cool thing that I think we'll see forward. I think, you know, the working from home thing is huge, in that for people, you know, who were forced into it, who might have wanted to try it, managers who were nervous about it, found that it did work. I do wonder what that will look like going forward, though, because certainly as a part-time working from home person for a long time, the experience of being one person working from home when most people in the office is very different to everyone working from home. And so the experience isn't necessarily going to be the same post-lockdown to say, you know, when everyone isn't working from home. I actually found it in many ways a more collegial working environment, that you know, everybody was on the same position of being at home, and you all kind of, you set up your processes working from home first, and that worked really well. I do think the retail side is where you'll see quite a lot of innovation. I know a lot of people, you know, doing home supermarket deliveries that had never tried it before and realized, you know, how convenient it is, the amount of time saved. I have a little one at home, and I certainly will probably be doing it from now on, because realizing that having my groceries just turn up rather than having to drag a three-year-old to the supermarket is worth more than paying a few dollars for a delivery. So I think that there's a lot of things. But, you know, I think it has pointed out, and maybe this is the next section, but it's pointed out some things we still need to work on. And even for New Zealand, the lack of connectivity for all, kind of digital inclusion. And that doesn't just include the connection, but the skills, you know, and ability to use the internet. There are real issues there. And I think the place that really showed through the most in New Zealand was around schooling. So I would say, you know, the same thing to you. We ended up, there was a lot of talk about e-learning, about rolling out devices and quick connectivity. And in the end, they set up TV channels and did TV programs, you know, and sent out packs of paper to lots of households. And, you know, and I think that's partly about the connectivity, about having the right platforms. My three-year-old was doing remote learning. And I'll tell you what, 30 under five-year-olds on a Zoom is not really the place for learning. There's a lot of screeching, but I think, you know, there was also some activities and videos and things they did that were really amazing. So, yeah.
You know, so I want to pick on that rural angle. And I'm going to say something here about a concern that I've had for a fair number of years now, actually, is the new digital divides that we've been building through various applications and services. And you know, one of the things that always pops up is that, you know, for instance, when an network operator launches a new service, are we going to go 5G? These days, the buzzword is 5G, and so on and so forth. But, you know, it's the quality of that connection that comes into play, doesn't it? Because about a year or so back, I happened to be in Delhi, and I was on a 4G network, supposedly. I realized that, you know, my 4G connection was probably behaving more like an edge connection rather than a 4G connection. So I ran some tests. And it so happened the day, 2 days after that, I was in Seoul, in Korea, and I ran the exact same test there. And of course, I was roaming on my phone with my providers. I was roaming in both cases, you know, logging onto a local network provider and so on. You know, I don't think it'll surprise you to say that the performance I had in Korea was somewhere in the vicinity of 100. But still 4G. My phone still told me it was a 4G connection. And so that's that new digital divide that I'm really concerned about. And it's not just, you know, whether it's 4G and what sort of throughput you're getting, but as well, the applications that we use. Someone mentioned how video traffic has increased, you know, people working from home, Zoom and other platforms that are around. And I think most of us, all of us on this call are perhaps a bit privileged in a way that we are able to use all these technologies. We can afford all this. But there are vast populations, sometimes even in developers like New Zealand, like Australia, that, you know, we have people who can't afford that connectivity. They don't have the devices to use this. So it's all good to say, you know, we'll go to telemedicine and online education and e-learning and this and that, and, you know, use e-commerce to order stuff. But if you don't have the foundational infrastructure to make it work, what do you do? And Osama, if I turn to you now, of course, India and even Bangladesh suffer from that significantly. So how do we deal with it, Osama? What do we need to do?
I'm so glad, Raj, you said quality of infrastructure, you know, because so far we have been really, you know, very happy that, you know, mobile connectivity and all kind of fragile connectivity is good enough to connect people. You know, we're very happy to say that we are mobile first country and so on and so forth. But as soon as the pandemic came, the quality infrastructure, number one, and number two, digital divide as an issue started coming to discussion after almost a decade. You know, we were only talking about digital inclusion or something like that, or digital digital exclusion, but not digital divide. And suddenly I had to write an article related to digital divide. I said, wow, this is a two decade old topic. But the fact is that India, a country like India and subcontinent actually being exposed at this point of time, when the education is locked down, health system is locked down, movement is locked down, All we have is how to rely on digital infrastructure. And therefore, it comes to our situation, can we do online transaction? Can we do online talking? Can we do video calling? Can we do Zoom? Can we send money online? Can we receive money online? Can we buy things online? Can we do counseling online? Everything can we do online? And no, we cannot. And there are several layers of this infrastructure, you know, quality of digital infrastructure. One is absence. The second is presence without performance, you know. So it's like you have 2G, but you can't do anything. You can perhaps only make a call. And that too, when you are able to pay for your talk time. And then the non-performing 3G. You know, which is 3G is always there, but like you said, it functions like edge, you know, it functions like 2G. And then comes the real broadband or ADSL or what you call as the unlimited bandwidth or something. Even the households, the afforded households have been suffering because of the quality of infrastructure, because now the whole house is using internet. You know, the children are using for education, somebody is using for entertainment, somebody is using for transaction. So we are certainly exposed at this point of time. Rural India is totally exposed because their education, when it is closed down, it is literally closed down. Urban areas can still talk to their teachers. They're still doing classes online. They're still doing instructions online. But rural India, 1.4 million schools, 250 million children, and 7 million teachers are totally shut down. They have no point of access with quality to have an educational transaction, you know. And when Suman was saying that even e-commerce, you know, when you do a small e-commerce, or for that matter, when the government is providing 500 rupees or 1,000 rupees as a subsidy to the people, poorest of the poor at the time of pandemic, they just don't know how to withdraw it because it's non-functional, because OTP doesn't work, or they don't have mobile, or the connectivity is older, or it's unpaid, and so on and so forth. And therefore, you can get ration. So you know, there is no doubt that this pandemic actually exposes a country to think that how at a rural level where 70% of population live, and now all the migrants going back, you need to create an infrastructure where institutions can perform online without fail. And education and health are the most important thing to, you know, leave away when the other things, you know. These are the two most important things. How do you build that? I mean, the way you have built it in the cities, you can easily build it to the rural. You have already taken fiber up to the level of village councils. You have all you have to do is make it functional at this point of time. But there is no alternative. We have to go up to the level of several Mbps of availability up to the household, if not up to the community level, so that there is a point of access which is available with unlimited bandwidth. Community networks, ISOC has worked, we have worked together. So, you know, community networks could be one of the possibilities, but certainly decentralization of ISP and the entrepreneurization of ISPs is one of the solutions that we must look at.
But there's also the affordability issue, isn't there? I mean, you know, we can take fiber to the home, literally, if we wanted to, in villages, for instance. But then how do they actually pay for the costs of using that technology? It's not just the access or subscription costs, but of course, it's also the cost of devices. So, Suman, maybe this is the perfect time for you to come in and share some thinking around that.
Yeah, actually, we're talking about e-commerce, we're talking about e-education, but it's very true what Usama said, that a large number of people actually in this country, especially in South Asia and maybe in African countries, actually have the similar situation. They don't have access to internet. And a large number of people using feature phone, even mobile internet is not accessible by them. This is very true. And Now we are seeing that telemedicine is coming to help. So for some people, at least, and in a day or quickly, we cannot do it for everyone. The infrastructure cannot be built in a short time. So in the pandemic time, we can use this technology for all of them. It's not possible literally, but probably what I think that even if we talk about India or Bangladesh or this region, we have to live with the pandemic for a few more months, what I can gauge at least. So what we can do at this moment, that is what I was thinking actually, that we cannot do online schooling in the villages. It's not possible at this moment. But one thing we can do actually, we need to make a hybrid kind of plan. If you look in Bangladesh, I can see that most of the villages are actually still out of COVID. They are COVID-free. There is no single patient in many villages. So if we do a better management, if we can lock this down, you can do your all business inside. Even if you're opening a school in those villages, at least 70% villages can open their school and go to school. I don't see any problem, provided that we're ensuring nobody is coming inside with an infection, or they can open shop, they can leave their economy and business running into those particular areas. But most affected part of the city, where we have to use this education, e-commerce, all these facilities. But eventually, definitely, I agree with Usama that now government should think that we need to make sure that all individuals in the country must have good internet connectivity. That is something we have to make it for facing any sort of disaster now we're having now in future. And we're not far away from that, actually. What Usama is mentioning, that there is a village in Bangladesh also, we reached, take our fiber extension to the union level, where we can offer 10 gig connectivity. Just you need to take it to the villages, either Wi-Fi or something, even or fiber to the home, what you mentioned. We're not far away from that. And along with that infrastructure, we need to enable service and the system, that now the education system is trying to learn how to do education. So we need to think about it in future, actually, how we can bring in all these people and we can really take the services to the village using the technology. And also the other purpose for the management, for the statistical analysis. We've seen this thing happen 3-4 months before in China, in Italy, especially in these equatorial nations. We are affected later, but we didn't prepare ourselves properly. So these are a few new learnings we need to take, and we need to think how we can best use of the technology, and probably we can handle it much better in the future. Probably you're getting some extra sound from my side, so I will stop myself now. And I can join later on. Thank you.
Thanks, Suman. So maybe this is a good time for me to bring in Adrian. Adrian, what are our participants asking us? Anything interesting?
Yes. So we've got a lot of questions from our attendees. I think we've talked a lot about the digital divide and the difference between the connected and the unconnected. But there's an interesting question from Muhammad Shahab Siddiqui, who asks, could you highlight the positive side of the pandemic? What sort of opportunity with reference to the internet, does the current situation shows from where you sit in different parts of the world?
Okay. And is there another question? Maybe we can take two or three questions and then
sure.
Answer.
A couple of questions about, so now we don't have a perfect infrastructure for everyone. But for those who are unconnected now, what should we do? Osama talked a bit about the different methods we can do, including community networks. I think people need more answers. Probably we can share a bit more information on these methods to close the divide, per se. Do you want one more?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, one more.
Okay. A couple of questions about how. A question from Samrit Kudesha. So from India does not have an extensive digital infrastructure now, again about infrastructure, but he's asking what kind of, it will take very long until we can connect everyone. So in the meantime, what's the next best technical alternative that we should pursue?
Yep. I mean, I think our vision is to connect everyone, but to connect everyone, it can't happen overnight either, right? It's really about how policies need to change. You know, on the same token, we've had governments who've been saying that they support broadband, and this, you know, the World Bank and other multilateral organizations have come out with various studies saying that We need broadband is critical for the economy to go forward. But it's also quite obvious that, you know, the investments in internet infrastructure, in broadband technologies, and the applications that go with it haven't been actually been what they should have been. And, you know, Alan and I both mentioned the cases in countries like Australia and New Zealand where we face those issues. So I'll turn to my panelists now. Who would like to have some of those questions?
Raj, I can actually talk about something about that. What positives actually we are getting from the pandemic? The first positive what I can think that it's exposed a lot of things. We were living on some heights, something we are doing which we doesn't need at all. So it's a hard really to have learned that many things we actually don't need in our life. And we can afford them, we can spend that time in a better way. Now we are able to meet our families, friends. We are meeting them virtually. But even before pandemic, we made ourselves so much busy with so many things, we really didn't have time to meet our family. Even what I can tell that my 6 brothers and sisters were living in the same city in Dhaka, and we usually meet maybe once in a month. But during pandemic time, actually virtually, we're talking every day. So there's the change, there's a reality, and we should find some time for our family, for our neighbors, and we can actually work less. We do not need to take that much stress what we usually take our earlier time. So that is one of the main positives probably I have learned in this pandemic. And let's not make our life so much complicated and busy. So it's out of technology, but that is one of my realization. And another thing I was telling that it has exposed a lot of things, like the exposed government, exposed business, exposed our healthcare system, it exposed our economy, education system. So we could have done it much better. And it is a great learning. If we take the learning from here, probably we can have a better future, better life in coming years. Our politicians should learn their mistakes. Everyone, it's true for everyone. If we want to learn, it's a great, great learning opportunity for us. Though we are incurring huge loss of life, economical loss, but a lot of positives here. And another thing, from another question, the last question I was talking about, that we cannot build broadband in a day, but what intermediate we can do. That is something very important, actually. There's something very critical that, for example, for information sharing, one thing very important is transparency, what we are not seeing in many government in many countries, that they are not doing it. And for education, another thing, you cannot do education in the village at this moment. But what we can do actually, we can have videos of the good classes. We can do it in the televisions, radio, the other medias we can use. It may not be that interactive, but at least the students sitting idle in the home in the village can have access to some information, even not to internet, but to other medias. So there are ways actually in everything you can, there are alternatives for business and everything. So apart from technology, in some cases, some intermediate technology we can use. In some cases, if it's not even technology, some better management can really help people. So that is 2 cents from my side.
So it sounds to me that we need to sort of relook or reimagine some of the things we've been doing in the past to see how we can adapt those. Alan, Osama, do you have some thoughts on the question?
Yeah. Alan, do you want to go first or do you allow me to? Okay, great. So I will take the positive one, and I will take a profoundly positive is that let's not work for economy. Let the economy, let's use economy for us. We are being used by economy. That's what the learning is, you know, from GDPs and all that. So we are certainly living an era of overworking, overearning, affluence, everything for each one of us and all that. So economic level and the living level has to go down. The second is certainly, there are many things. We were counting that, are we dying of pandemic more or we are saving life because of accident more? There is no accident, on the roads because we are not driving around. So probability of dying out of accident is much lesser, especially in a country like India where the traffic is always chaotic. And there are many, many more things. But in one sentence, I think nature has been allowed to flourish. humans have been made less intervening, and therefore rivers are becoming much more cleaner. The natural habitats are becoming much better because of our lesser activities. So should we act less is the lesson that we need to learn, you know, in our life. Coming to connectivity, what Adrian found out is that I have a solution for quick fix and the long fix. A long fix certainly is required to overcome bureaucratic hassles for last mile connectivity, because in India, at least I can tell that last mile connectivity with fiber is already done to the village level, but it's not functional. So can that be made functional immediately with various kind of options? And I don't want to get into detail, but that is possible. But quick fix is that, can we declare connectivity as a fundamental right and almost to the level of access to food, and make it available either free of cost or free to access or subsidized to access and so on and so forth. Because that will generate load on the user's side and pressure on the provider side. And therefore, you know, that itself will create better infrastructure and more used infrastructure.
Osama, let me challenge you on that a little bit. And the challenge I have for you is, I know I agree, let's make this a right, but we still have vast populations around the world who don't have clean water, who don't have electricity. So how do you prioritize between clean food, nutritious, clean water, nutritious food, and electricity? And then you've got the internet on top of that. So how do you prioritize? How does the government prioritize?
So, Raj, I'm sure I can remind you some of our drawing room discussion that access to food or access to water or access to basic has now subjected to access to information, you know, because I cannot have my ration, which is food, without having my biometric checked, which is access to information and digital and internet infrastructure. So, therefore, even what you are saying is right. You know, they are via information. They are via the tools of digital. And therefore, subsidizing and making it open and making it primarily available will increase the number of people's access to the basic requirement of humans, which is water, roti kapda makan, which is bread, house, and you know, and the clothing. Water is not there, but I think it is part of that roti, you know, which is bread. And I agree with you, but the point is that our via media is internet and data and talk time and ISP, and therefore this must be made available in categorization of either subsidized or free or low cost or something like that, so that affordability increases, you know. And device affordability, you have already talked, everybody else has talked, that goes with that one. And the long term is yes, in Bangladesh, in Nepal, in India, in all South Asian countries, certainly there has been a lot of work till the last mile, but it is just not made decentralized to make it available to the people and the local institution in an entrepreneurial manner. Why can't ISP be a single person at a village level to provide internet? Just open it up, you know, and you will see that it will flourish. Why can't I build my own Wi-Fi? Give me the license easily, you know, at low cost, I will build it. So, you know, entrepreneurization is very, very important. And maybe now it's time, because we don't have too many livelihoods left in any case. It's better that we create internet and access as a means of livelihood and entrepreneurship for the people to create new business and new opportunity to earn money.
Yeah, so I'll touch on all three of the questions. I'll start out with the positive, the opportunity, and follow on from what Osama was saying, in that I think it's about the opportunity. The positive is I can see clearly how the internet can contribute, and I think a lot more of us can, to mitigating and stopping climate change related, you know, global disaster. We still are facing climate change, and you know, it has the potential to have, you know, as horrible an impact as the current pandemic is having. And certainly, I think, you know, like telemedicine, when you live it, you see how it works. That, you know, things like working from home, the reduction of car transport, reduction of flights, a range of ways that we can really think about how the internet, you know, can be a part of our lives in a way that reduces carbon emissions, that provides a healthier planet, that helps create a planet to heal itself, to continue to support us as humans. So I think that's, you know, an important opportunity that we have to seize now. Now is the time. This is a moment to learn that. So I hope we will. And in terms of, you know, infrastructure, I guess I would close by sort of promoting internet. And that just this week or end of last week launched a digital inclusion 5-point plan. And it is about dealing with, you know, the aspects of digital divide in New Zealand. And I think that the way forward on those long and short term, you know, it lists some things to tackle. But what for me is important is that we developed it with community organizations and people on the ground, you know, a range of technical and, you know, human rights, disability, you know, community civil society organizations who understand their communities, their needs, what can be done to create the digital inclusion that they need, you know, quickly, but also for the long-term good, and, you know, have dozens of signatories now to it, you know, working to get government support for those initiatives. And I think that's the thing, is that we have to, there isn't a silver bullet, 5G, you know, mobile, it's about working together to do this and listening to people who, you know their circumstances and what they need, because we all understand now how important the internet is.
Thanks for that, Ellen, and congratulations to Internet New Zealand for your initiative on the 5-point plan. So, you know, wonderful to hear that. Adrian, I think we can take one more question before we start closing this session out. Is there anything that you would prioritize in terms of questions, which is really interesting?
Well, I have to say thank you for all the questions. We have a lot more than we can answer, but still thank you for the questions. I'll just pick one that's interesting to me. I'd like the panelists to discuss when we look at how different countries approach the pandemic, what kind of policies they've taken. Is there such a thing as an Asian approach as compared to Western approach? So the question is, would you say Asian countries are doing this better than Western countries? Please.
So, you know, I think the approach, I mean, so the overall approach to the pandemic, I think, has been interesting. And I think if you look across the Asia-Pacific region, I don't think there's been one type of response. I think there's been multiple types of responses. You know, New Zealand, for example, is very strict. India did it in 4 hours, and got various bits in between. Singapore was sort of strict, but it was also a bit relaxed. And then, of course, they missed a few things, and that came back to bite quite badly in the situation they're in now. So I know, I think there's been a multitude of approaches. But one thing I think that's been striking for me is the lack of preparedness that I think most countries had. And the other thing that's really come to the fore, frankly, is the lack of leadership. You know, we look to our politicians and our leaders to guide us through. Most of them were fumbling for a while. Some of them are still clueless, frankly. This morning I was in a conversation with another colleague, and the point I made to her was, which is a point a friend of mine made to me yesterday, that, you know, we don't seem to have real leaders and statesmen and stateswomen anymore. What we have is people who want to be politicians, who want to run a country. It's very different. And that person also said that, you know, if there's one prime minister I would like to have, it's the New Zealand prime minister to be my prime minister, you know.
I think the one thing I wanted to mention in this was about that we touched on misinformation and disinformation and communication being really important, and the leadership we've had, you know, and the trust. In some ways, we've had a lot of, you know, we have a good leader, but we've also had some tragedy in the year before this with the shootings in Christchurch, with a volcanic eruption at the end of the year that took a lot of lives. And so there's been trust buildup in our leaders under difficult circumstances over the last year. But, you know, there's also been, they've used the internet to communicate well. Like one of the mainstays of people during the lockdown was there was a 1 p.m. press conference that was the prime minister and our director general of health. And they got up and they told you what you needed to know. And it was for the media. They were in the room, but they live streamed it. And, you know, there were millions of people every day in New Zealand that watched every day, you know, after lunch, you get your cup of tea and you watch the prime minister and see what's happening. And they complemented that with, you know, a website. You know, we've just had an app launched today, which will be interesting to see. They did flyers, posters, billboards as well. But I think that that consistent, you know, deep communication, they've engaged a lot of academic and science communicators who they've brought in to do reports that they've talked about that have done stuff on social media to help people understand the issues behind what the leaders are telling you has been so important. So, I mean, I do think, you know, leadership and communication is really important. And, you know, but, you know, having said that, we're still facing, and we haven't touched on it, we know we need to finish, but, you know, things like the 5G kind of disinformation that's going around related to COVID is still popping up here, you know, and it's a real concern that you do need communication to be really clear and good leadership to prevent, to get good action, but also to prevent, you know, difficulty.
So, and you're quite right there. I think the pandemic was also an opportunity for the conspiracy cranks to come out in droves and do their thing, you know, which was...
And I think that's going to be a huge risk going forward with this. Like, it really concerns me. And the role the internet plays in that and social media platforms is something that we're watching closely. But again, that comes, you know, communication, leadership are really important. And then countries where you see that that is particularly not strong, I think is where you see the real misinformation problems, you know, arise.
So we are a bit beyond time, so I think we'll need to wrap up now. So what I'll do is I'll ask, starting with Suman, I'll ask each of my guests to give us a very short closing comment. And in addition to that, and maybe you want to speak to what we just discussed here, but as well, I want to hear from you, if there's one thing we need to do different, what would it be? In the learnings that we've had using the internet and technologies to deal with this pandemic, what is your one recommendation to either, you know, do something better, or if you've seen something that's a best practice? Or if there's something we did terribly wrong in our respective countries, you know, what's that one thing we need to fix? So, starting.
Thank you, Raj. Actually, it's not about technology or any particular technology that's solved. But I think you actually answered the questions very nicely just a few seconds before that about the leadership. We need real leader for the people, and they need to take timely decision. And to support them, there are enough knowledge, enough technology, enough expertise, just they need to come out of their shells. We don't need politicians running countries, you mentioned. We need leaders. We need leaders who feels for the people, would like to improve the situation of the country and come out of this situation. That is what we need. There are enough knowledge, enough expertise, enough technology, but just they need to open up, they need to take support from others. That's all. That's all we need at this moment.
Oh, thanks, Owen. And I'm in absolute agreement with you on that one. Osama, what do you reckon?
Yeah, so beside agreeing to Ellen and Suman, I would add that the most important thing is how to control dissemination of right information and allow free access to information and fight misinformation in these kind of situation is the biggest issue that is challenging and that we should take. And of course, Ellen has already said, and Suman, that leadership plays a lot of role in that one. And how do we do that? That's one thing that is required, is how to make sure that information flows well, correct, reaches everyone, everything will be all right.
Ellen, you want to have the last word before I wrap up?
No, I think I said mine, but I would just, the final would be, you know, to add to that leadership, cooperation. I've been disappointed to see the failure of multilateralism and, you know, politicians to work together. Little things like this of sharing, of learning from each other, but also, you know, looking to our leaders and organizations to actually, this is a global pandemic and we need to be working together as a planet and as people.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much. So I'd just like to thank my guests on the on APEC Insights today. Much appreciate your time and for contributing to this discussion. As I mentioned, this was a pilot event for us to see how things would work out. We've had good attendance from what I understand, and I hope the people attending enjoyed the discussion. I think we've covered quite a few areas. We looked at a few different things, including identifying leadership as the major issue. I think there was consensus on that one. So I do hope you will join us for a future edition of APEC Insights. We hope to be back in a couple of weeks' time. And you know, please do subscribe to our Facebook page and our Twitter handles. Thank you for joining us. Be safe, be well. See you again soon.
Thank you, Raj, for bringing us all together. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you all. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Take care.
We are almost at the end of Freedom Chowdhury podcast. Hope you found this episode useful and interesting. However, as always, we eagerly wait for your genuine comments on our podcast issues. Myself, Deepa Adhikari, signing out for today. Thank you for listening us. Namaste.